Hi folks, just to let you know that over the next few days we will be bringing you podcasts that we recorded in September and October in partnership with Peter Maguire and the brilliant work that he did in Noteworthy with the Speaker Survive series, the award-winning work he did with the Speaker Survive series. The links to the articles are included in the podcast. These podcasts, if you are a Patreon subscriber, you've probably heard them as they were done, so you know you can skip through, but I wouldn't. I'd go and listen to them again. It's an important series and brilliant work by Peter, and we do want to thank him and the folks for Noteworthy for trusting us to talk to the contributors, and we want to especially thank the people who are brave enough to tell their stories in their own voices. Listen, I just want to say to you, if you're listening now, please do consider maybe heading over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's heading into 2021, and we would really appreciate if we could have your support and just get a little bit more certainty about what we're going to be doing as the months come on. Other than that, do listen to these stories. They are powerful testimonies, and there's a lot we need to learn. Thanks for the support.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today, as promised, we are returning to the Speak or Survive articles that Peter Maguire wrote, and some of the contributors to that, and some of the ideas around that, and some of the stuff that we think deserve a wider audience. And how do you segue from that into asking people to actually support the podcast? I don't know, but Martin,
it's very easy. Look, stick your hand in your pocket, price of a cup of coffee, support our podcasts. We try to give public service. That's what we try to do. So stick your hand in your pocket, patreon.com/tortoiseshack, price of a cup of coffee, help keep us on the road. Thank you.
We are thrilled to be joined on the line from Cork by Stuart Neilson, writer, lecturer, late diagnosed Asperger, Stuart, at age 45 when you were diagnosed.
Yes, I'd always had difficulties, but that was when I got the diagnosis.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that on a side note, because of obviously, you know, people who I know who've had earlier diagnosis and sort of said, I always suspected I was, but I didn't want to put a label on it. But nonetheless, look, it's lovely to put a face to the name, and thank you so much for giving us your time. I want to start with, we spoke about we spoke to Peter, who wrote the piece, the Speaker Survive piece, and I know you contributed to that. But if we could frame it first of all in survivors of sexual abuse and sexual violence and how it impacts them over their lifetime. Could you speak a little bit about that for us?
If I start by what actually happened to me is, in my primary school, I was raped by another pupil. And the school's reaction to that was to effectively cover it up. And I was stoned half to death. I was in hospital with a blood transfusion following the beating, and grew up with this always being called gay, always being blamed for what had happened to me. No action was taken at all to stop that kind of behavior happening that happened to other people. And then in secondary school, I was taken under the wing of a very kindly teacher. And obviously you can see this coming now, but from then I was in remedial ed. I was struggling, and this guy was really, really nice to me. And then after 6 months, he sexually assaulted me. So that's my experience of sexual assault. It's happened twice. And I think the Asperger syndrome is relevant, that I think there's a hunt for vulnerable people who will feel a need to be protected or looked after or some other kind of difficulty that they're having in their life. So I think there's a relationship there that I have a predisposition to not noticing people are taking advantage. So I walked into it, and the same kind of things have happened in adulthood with bullying. I think there's a relationship there of the kind of people that do it look for vulnerability. They know the kind of victims they want. But lifelong, it's had an effect on, I would say, every day of my life. I can remember the things that happened. I'm frightened of being in a room with just one person, especially a man. I'm not that frightened of women because it's involved men, and women statistically are very rarely abusers, but they do. So I don't take lifts home from colleagues. I take the stairs in preference to getting into the lift with other people. It's something that people would notice at work. Like, why is this person refusing to be in a room, refusing to take the lift? So it has a lifelong impact. And on top of that, there are triggers like a tobacco smell, not any tobacco, but a specific tobacco. And I'm suddenly back in that abusive environment. Certain kinds of clothing, certain mannerisms, and it's not the person's fault, but I might see somebody behaving in a particular way or with a particular walk, and that triggers in me the memory. And that's 40 years on.
I was just going to say, you were very, very young, and primary school is very young. And it's easy to understand how this can have a lasting impact on somebody. I mean, what happens to us in childhood stays with us for a lifetime. Do you think there is enough data available on whether this, and it's horrific crime in our society and damaging crime in our society, is on the increase or on the decrease?
I lecture and sometimes I talk about abuse in relation to disability. And I always preface it by saying, don't jump up and say me too, because you can't take it back. But I can see from the front of the room when I'm lecturing students who nod along, and they are recollecting the same experiences. So I can see amongst even school children, my son has just finished school this year, but even amongst his friends, I can see there is abuse there. But we have no idea how much. And in 2002, the Savvy Report collected excellent data on the prevalence of sexual violence. And we need a repeat of that kind of detailed understanding of the victim's perspective of abuse. And we don't have it from public data.
Does it make you feel a little helpless when you're looking into their faces and you know and you can sense, you can see yourself in them? Do you feel that something should have changed in the interim so that they're not holding this secret and there is something there for them?
Definitely, but I don't know. I mean, as a parent in a playground, seeing a child who's got the signs of abuse, you don't know who did it, you don't know what it is. It could be something like cancer in the family, and their behavior might be exactly the same. It's not abuse. Mm. So you don't know the reasons why, but you can see traumatized, distressed children. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to know, but we don't listen. I think when a child says something, we're very quick as adults to minimize it and to find some way to calm down the behavior without listening, because it's hard to listen. And I think most people just don't want to listen.
We just want to fix and move on. The human instinct is to find out what's broken, replace it, and move on. And I'm just struck by what you say about 40 years ago and what they refer to as like life limiting conditions. And you've actually described them insofar as it's changed your ability to socialize in effect in many ways. In terms of the Savvy Report, what did they get right and what should we be pushing for that becomes, we should be looking at?
I think from public data, we know there are children in care because there are allegations of abuse. We know there are people who report abuse to the Gardaí or to other kinds of services in huge numbers. And of those that do report, a tiny percentage end up in a prosecution and a guilty verdict. Mm. And the best guess is something like 8% is reported. And that means we've got, 15,000 events of sexual abuse occurring to children every year in Ireland. It's an immense number. And then is it 90 prosecutions? The relationship between the events and the prosecutions is just overwhelmingly that we're not seeing it. We're choosing not to see it. Hmm. And I think what Savvy got right was asking, I suppose, adults to go back to that childhood from the place of safety that adults are in, and get them to report what happened, who helped, who didn't help, where it happened, the kind of environment that enable abuse.
There is a figure out there that 1 in 4 women and 1 in 6 men have been abused as a child. Is that figure reliable, or do we think it's higher?
I don't know. I think that's something that a decent survey would find out. That's the kind of levels that Savvy would agree with.
Yes.
And they're the kind of levels in other European countries. So it seems like a reasonable ballpark. I mean, these are real lives to be talking about the ballpark figure rather than actually prosecutions. But maybe not prosecutions, because sometimes prosecution isn't the best way of dealing with abuse in a family or abuse in a relationship of some kind.
What can we do about structural issues, such as empty rooms, sole access to children? How can we make sure that and that coercion is addressed as well? How do we deal with those issues?
I think at the moment, when I see child protection policy, it's like an ISO 9000 checklist that you've got to vet it to your staff, that you've sent your staff to a training session, that you have somebody who's named as the, I can't think of the right title, a kind of abuse leader. Person.
Yeah, yeah. It's to say, in any industry, they turn around and say, "Well, you're the data protection officer for this office." You know, so similar kind of.
It's a similar kind of post, but it's like making a checklist for the insurer.
Yeah.
Have you done the reasonable things? But we already know less than 1% of sexual crimes result in a prosecution and a guilty verdict. So 99% of all child abusers are not on the sex offenders register because they haven't been prosecuted. So finding that your staff are not on the sex offenders register isn't a very good test of your staff not being sex offenders. So I think things like that are really missing, that we need the kind of structural things. When a room is unoccupied, is it locked? Is there an accessible place where somebody can abuse? Are there times where people have one-to-one access to children, and not even children, but other colleagues? Are there places and times that your workplace permits people to be alone in ways that coercion could take place? And then when somebody does report coercion, are you doing anything about it? We've seen these things with university staff where they're reporting levels of sexual harassment and bullying that have gone on years. And the department has said, it's not happening. And then right at the end, when somebody's got a prosecution in a court, the department comes back and said, we don't have any tolerance for sexual harassment. And obviously, they've tolerated it for the last 10 years of that person's life.
And it does become institutionalized. An institution protects the institution. I mean, that after a number of years, any institution's reflex is to protect the institution and not to protect the individual. How do we address that? How do we get at that?
I don't know why institutions believe that the behavior of their staff on that level is part of their reputation. Or schools. Why do schools think their teachers' behavior is part of their reputation? Because it seems to be purely to protect the reputation of the school. And I think you can unlink that really easily and say, we found this member of staff doing something horrendous, and we acted on it. And wouldn't that give you it certainly gives me a better feeling about the institution that we act on abuse than we're a place where abuse never happens.
Oh, well, I completely agree with you.
I'm reminded, Martin, of the idea of, you know, A friend of mine goes into schools and gives talks about his childhood and his drug use and things like that. And he talks about it, and they say to him, "Well, don't mention X because we don't have that problem here." And it might be, and you can almost pick the schools by, shall I say, class. That, you know, that problem doesn't exist here, and that problem exists elsewhere, and it becomes this kind of about the reputation of the school. And inevitably, he says, "Yeah, yeah, yeah," and then the first thing he puts to the audience is the thing he told not to address, and inevitably, the hands go up and say, "Yes, we've experienced that here," you know. And it's very much as you say, Stuart. You outlined it really well. That why should it's more suspicious if you were to look into your organization, if you were a corporation, and say, "Oh, we don't have any people like that here." That's a red flag more so than we actually, you know.
We've never had an employee engaging in fraud or pilfering petty cash.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, get a grip. Just on the, I suppose, to bring it back, though, to that sense of, as you said, you, even in your own personal case, there was no, you were made feel responsible. You were made feel that you somehow brought it up on yourself. And we see that even in some of the people who we've spoken to before, and we still see it, you know, it pervades actually some parts of our legal system still, sadly, where the question is asked, you know, of the victim, what way did they portray themselves, and where are they asking for it? How do we break that link?
When I reported this to the police, which is very recent, after the Jimmy Savile thing, I reported this to the police in the UK where it happened. And their first question was, "Did you consent?" I mean, I was, 10 years old? And they're saying, "Did you consent?" And that has to change. A child can't consent. You can't say this is some sexy relationship between a child and up to the age of consent, which is 17 here. Nobody can. I mean, that's child abuse at best and rape at worst. I think anonymity, we're maybe going a little bit the wrong way on anonymity, because there's no anonymity for any other kind of crime. And it's saying this is a shameful thing. It's shameful for the victim. It's shameful for the perpetrator. It's shameful for anyone who brings a false accusation. It's shameful for the employer, the school, for society to even have these cases. And I think anonymity should change to say we're not actually ashamed of being the victims of these crimes.
What about reporting of these issues? We've seen lately here in Ireland some really salacious reporting of child rape, really nasty stuff. Do the press have an onus to handle this as adults and stop looking for the clickbait headlines?
There was one recently, a 15-year-old girl exchanged sex for drugs. Mm. And whatever was happening in that place, it wasn't a 15-year-old who was in charge. It was the adults who raped her. Mm. And I think that kind of reporting, that as a headline, is just, it's so offensive on every level. And I think if we don't stop buying papers, we've got to keep telling them we don't want to read it like that.
Yeah, and there is that conundrum where a newspaper readership is dropping, and yet they continue to do these things that belong in a Bernard Manning era. You know, the world has moved on an awful lot. It's very difficult to understand why they continue down that line. I don't get it. I'm afraid I don't get it. Should there be a press authority that has some authority to say, no, you must report properly?
There is an authority, isn't there?
There is, I mean, yeah.
I've never used the press complaints. I've used the broadcasting complaints, but I haven't used... There is one, is there?
There is, but the difference, I suppose, is so you'll have a court reporter who is very matter of factly, and he will, you know. So they're restricted in what they can say. They have to say alleged. They have to say, you know, all of these things whereby they may have to carry on in a certain manner. but you will have a sub-editor who might write a headline. And actually then, as you said in that case, they used the phrase coked up was one of the phrases that was used. And initially that was then changed later on. But they referred to the drug use as coked out 15-year-old. And you're like, oh my God, what, like in no world is that actually, it's not morally right, it's not ethically right. And from a journalistic point of view, you couldn't stand over that and think that that was doing service to informing people of events. I would ask though, just I suppose, about the idea of shame. So we're having this conversation here now. You've been very open and frank about your own experiences. We've seen Ireland having to own up to a lot of our past in terms of the shameful things that we've done, in terms of Magdalene laundries, and even around as recent as, you know, the repeal movement, where women had to come out and tell their own stories of how they were actually criminals for doing the things that we do. How do we break that silence, and how do we remove that stigma? If that's not too big a question.
I think people speaking out is the only way to break it, to show that they are human beings, people who are hidden behind the labels of survivor of sexual abuse or victim of sexual abuse, and they become just storified in a way that's not nice. And they become somebody else's story. Like that girl in the news is not a story about her life and her experience. It's a story about Dublin drug use. And she's become a kind of pawn in that bigger narrative, rather than being a story about how did a 15-year-old girl ever end up in that kind of an environment? How has society failed so much to listen to what she needed before she got there?
How many opportunities did we not take to... Yeah, I fully agree with you. I just also think it's important that, like, you're such a clear speaker on this. I just think it's amazing that we don't have enough of these conversations, and we definitely need to see that. The idea of shame and for victims is just it needs to be pushed back on all fronts. Just if I can go back finally for me to the prosecution numbers and that, I mean, you're talking, you know, 8% get reported, like less than half of that go to court, less than half of that again get a prosecution, and you're down to, you know,
about times 10.
Yeah. So As a society, is that something that is there something legislatively? Is there something in how we police it, or is it just a combination of us as a society? As you quite rightly put out earlier, we don't really want to talk about it. It's like, give it anonymity, pretend it's not there, or is there other ways or other models that are doing it better?
I think there are models doing it worse. I saw the UK where they were talking about 2 years ago about, I can't remember the wording, was it assuming that the victim is telling the truth, that prosecutors and police should always assume that the victim is telling the truth. Mm. And from that moment, the Crown Prosecution Service realised the numbers would completely overwhelm the system, and rewrote the guidelines on the levels required before a prosecution is initiated. So they've actually ended up looking at this really seriously and saying, we're going to take the victim's side, and then saying, oh my God, we can't cope. And we're going to make it really hard to get a case. And the case numbers have dropped by 30%.
So that's incredible. That is incredible. Stuart, I have one last question for you. You didn't get to, I suppose, fully address this matter till you were in your 40s. Am I right about that? Has your life been better since?
Since out publicly about it?
Yes.
I think it has, yes.
Has it improved?
And the teacher has died. He died in, I think, 2011. And the other pupil claims that it never happened. And, of course, there's no kind of evidence. The schools claimed to have been flooded, so they lost all the records and the hospital records of the physical assault are missing. There's actually no evidence left that any of this happened except in my head.
But does it give you some closure on it, or will you ever have closure on it?
I think I'm comfortable with it now. I don't know if that's the same as closure. I've been through a lot of therapy where people talk about journeys and closure, and I just find it very hard. I was briefly in group therapy with other people who'd been sexually abused, and I couldn't cope with any of the shared trauma. It's actually worse than my own.
That's understandable. Stuart, look, yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this chat with us this morning. We really do appreciate it, and we understand that it takes great grit and sand to stand up and say, this happened to me. And we're eternally grateful to you for having a chat with us.
Thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. We hope you enjoyed that. I really appreciate Stuart's time. Stay tuned over the next few days. We have another couple of contributors coming your way. And please do consider supporting the work. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We really would appreciate if you threw a few quid in. It makes all the difference, keeps us viable, and helps us keep these podcasts going. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.